stars and stripes. Dumpster fire vibe. Come on. All American why? All American why? All American why? Ask yourself the American why.
Hello, excessive thinkers. Welcome to another episode of All American Why. The question we're asking today is, why does comedy matter when everything feels broken? And I mean broken, broken. Politically, socially, emotionally, democratically, spiritually. IKEA furniture with one or several screws or pegs missing broken. You're putting together a dresser that should be called Fuck This Shit, which could actually mean something more inspiring and Swedish. Since we aren't pushing drugs here, except for maybe the following, caffeine, antidepressants, and occasional or not so occasional weed and alcohol, we need to rely on laughter. People say laughter is the best medicine. It's probably also a popular sign you can buy at Home Goods or TJ Maxx. Before you laugh at that, know that I'm a Maxinista and rebuilt my credit with my TJ Maxx card. Sure, you can do the same. You're welcome. The expression laughter is the best medicine is actually quite ancient. I don't know too much about the Bible other than it's suspiciously not on book ban list, even though it features sex, incest, adultery, and violence. But laughter is the best medicine / a cheerful heart is good medicine shows up in Proverbs 17:22, in ancient Greek medicine, and in modern neuroscience. Laughter has scientifically been shown to lower cortisol, release endorphins, and tell your nervous system you're not being chased by a bear right now. You may be thinking, well, what if that bear is funny? Can I laugh at the bear and run from the bear at the same time? That's your call. Here's the truth about laughter in America. Every time America goes through a hard moment, we don't stop laughing. We change why we're laughing. During the Great Depression, when unemployment hit nearly 25% and people were losing everything, comedy didn't disappear. It exploded. People packed movie theaters to watch Charlie Chaplin get swallowed by factory machines in modern times. There's a gag where he's fed by a machine designed to make workers more efficient, and it almost kills him. The joke wasn't, poverty is funny. The joke was, this system is absurd, and you are not broken for struggling inside of it. After World War II, for quite some time, there was this unspoken rule that you don't joke about Nazis. Then, in 1967, outrageous but brilliant Mel Brooks came along and said, actually, I do want to joke about Nazis, and you should do the same. In the producers, fascism isn't terrifying. It's presented as theatrical, insecure, obsessed with costumes, desperate for applause. Nazis became bad theater. Well, good theater in that the movie and the stage production did incredibly well. Brooks later said, if you can make Hitler ridiculous, you take away his power. That wasn't denial, that was survival. Long before podcasts and TikTok, Mark Twain was not just an author. He was a professional humorist touring the country, selling out lecture halls, doing what was basically 19th century stand-up. His entire move was taking political and moral logic, repeating it calmly and politely, and letting the audience slowly realize that it was okay to laugh. Here's one of my favorite one-liners that he said. Suppose you were an idiot, and suppose you were a member of Congress, but I repeat myself. Twain would say things like this calmly, let the joke sit with people, and then get them to awkwardly but joyfully laugh. Another example is Dick Gregory, who we should talk about more. During the Civil Rights era, Gregory, one of the first black comedians to regularly perform for white audiences, would joke directly to white people about how they, white people, were terrified of sharing a lunch counter with him, but perfectly fine asking him to fight their wars, take out their trash, or entertain them. This doesn't sound like a joke because it was so real and so righteous to call out the racism that he actually lived, but for some reason the white folks loved it and hollered. Around the same time, comedian Lenny Bruce was getting arrested for obscenity, not because his jokes were wild, but because they were honest. Religions, politics, sex, Lenny just said the quiet parts out loud. Every generation that says comedy has gone too far is replaying that exact argument. Lenny used to tell people both in person and on stage, "I'm not a comedian, I'm a social critic." And then there's Bob Hope, who played a very different but equally important role. Bob Hope wasn't there to tear down the system. He was there to get people through it. During World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and well into the Cold War, Hope performed thousands of shows for U.S. troops overseas. Not once or twice, but for decades. His comedy wasn't radical. It was reassuring. Jokes about home, about politics, just sharp enough to feel current about the shared experience. The message was simple. You're still connected to home. You're still human. And someone sees you. That kind of comedy matters too, because not every moment needs outrage. Some of these moments need steadiness. During Vietnam and Watergate, Americans realized the government lies a lot. Does that sound familiar to you? I'm looking at you, Don the Con, Christy Gnome, and numerous others. Enter George Carlin, who didn't just tell jokes, he translated propaganda. George said things like, "Political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable." He also said, "They don't want an informed electorate." And he said, "We don't kill people anymore, we neutralize them." This is another great one he said. "Smug, greedy, well-fed white people have invented a language to conceal their sins." The laugh came from clarity, and clarity was relief. Saying the things out loud that the people listening were actually thinking, but too afraid to say themselves, has always been such a vital part of using humor to get through hard times. We can also talk about comedians who used comedy to deal with their own pain, and how they themselves on stage served as representation for the public. Richard Pryor is a great example. He changed comedy by refusing to distance himself from pain, racism, addiction, trauma. He didn't say, "Look at those people." He said, "Look at me. This is hurt." People laughed because they weren't alone anymore. Eddie Murphy followed with swagger and confidence during the Reagan era, mocking authority and respectability politics like someone who absolutely didn't ask for permission. Sometimes confidence itself is the joke and the medicine. Women were doing this too, loudly. Lucille Ball was breaking gender norms during the Cold War by being chaotic in a culture obsessed with control. America wanted calm, proper, perfect homemakers. Lucy showed up and said, "Okay, but what if this is impossible?" We watched Lucy in the chocolate factory where she's supposed to neatly wrap candy on an assembly line and instead start shoving chocolates in her mouth because the pace is just inhuman. The joke is not that Lucy is bad at the job. The joke is that the job is ridiculous. Or Vita Meta Vegemin, where she's told this health tonic is good for her, ignores the fact that it's basically alcohol and keeps drinking it until she's clearly drunk while insisting she feels fine. That's a wellness scam joke before wellness scams were cool. There's also the bread that keeps rising, the wine stomping disaster. Lucy wasn't failing, the system was. And in a world demanding perfection, watching her fall apart on camera felt incredible and relatable. Joan Rivers joked about aging, death, and grief while living through them, proving you don't have to heal before you laugh. Sometimes laughing itself is the healing. Robin Williams became America's comfort comic. With his speed, voices, and absurdity, he used laughter as oxygen when slowing down hurt too much. His stand-up was great, but his acting was monumental. To this day, Mrs. Doubtfire and The Birdcage are two of my favorite films. On a side note, his death also reminds us that we are all layered human beings with complex emotions and often hidden struggles. This wouldn't be a proper episode without talking about what happened after September 11th. Because after 9/11, comedy didn't just slow down, it stopped. Late night shows went off the air, monologues disappeared, there was a real public question about whether humor was even allowed anymore. When Saturday Night Live returned a few weeks later, it opened without a joke. Firefighters and first responders stood on stage. The episode was hosted by the then celebrated Rudy Giuliani, who at the time was widely known as America's mayor, which I will note for the historical record is not how I would describe him now. Bat shit crazy comes to mind. Sorry, not sorry. Backstage at that show, Lorne Michaels turned to Jon Stewart and asked a genuine question, not a setup. Can we be funny? Stewart paused and said, "Why start now?" The audience laughed, but not because things were okay. They laughed because they recognized the moment. The laugh wasn't relief, it was recognition. We were all still grieving, we were all still scared, still unsure what came next, but we were still here. These openings to All American Why aren't long enough to tell you all of the things. So, we're going to fast forward to the Trump era, a time when satire stopped exaggerating and started documenting. The Onion became real life, and real life became The Onion. The Daily Show, Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, the last few years of The Colbert Report, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, all of these explained policy better than cable news, with charts, swearing, and visible despair. The newer show, Have I Got News For You, does a similar thing, but the interesting thing is that it's actually a news channel putting it on. CNN, with the show Have I Got News For You, is basically telling us it knows that life is absurd, and why not get you what you need? News with laughter delivered by comedians and their fun guests. Here's the thing that people don't say enough. Some of the funniest people are dark. Some of the funniest people are deeply intellectual. Some of the funniest people are funny because they think too much, feel too much, and notice everything. Comedy isn't shallow. And comedy isn't just something famous people do on stages or on TV. It's the group text that saves your day. It's the meme that hits you exactly where you need it. It's the friend who cracks a joke at the worst possible moment and somehow makes it okay to breathe again. It's also the terrible dad joke. Yes, those count. In fact, sometimes they count the most. Like this one. Why don't scientists trust atoms? Because they make up everything. Is that a good joke? No. Does it lower the emotional temperature of the room by about 15%? Absolutely. Or the other classic, I'm reading a book about anti-gravity. I just can't put it down. Bad jokes are still medicine. They're accessible, they're communal. They say I'm trying, and that matters. That's one reason why my husband and I watch The Golden Girls over and over before bedtime. And I mean over and over. We watch The Golden Girls before bed several nights a week, not because it's edgy or new, but it was before its time. We watch it because it's familiar, funny, and deeply humane. It reminds you that people are messy, friendships matter, and you don't have to be perfect to be loved. Broad City, another one of our favorites, tells a different truth. Everything might be on fire, but friendship helps a lot. And then there's Parks and Recreation, which we come back to when we still need a reminder that caring isn't naive, public service isn't stupid, and trying still counts. I still think about DJ Roomba and have considered buying a Roomba, not for the vacuuming features, but so that I can have music traveling through the house. I don't think our dogs would approve of that, though. Comedy helps us regulate. It helps us connect. It helps us stay open. But for a quick moment of honesty, comedy isn't perfect. It can punch down, it can numb instead of heal, it can turn into cruelty instead of connection. But when comedy is doing its job, it doesn't erase pain. What it does is it makes room for truth. Authoritarianism, you see, loves a humorless culture. Fear thrives where curiosity dies. Comedy is democratic infrastructure. It's how we question power without losing our humanity. So the question isn't really whether comedy matters. The question is what kind of comedy we protect right now. Who gets to laugh? Who gets listened to? And whether we're laughing because we see the truth or because we're avoiding it. Comedy doesn't say nothing matters. Comedy says things matter so much that pretending they're normal would be dishonest. So when everything feels broken, when you're hurt, confused, overwhelmed, or just deeply done, laughter isn't the distraction. It's the medicine that gets you through the night. And with that, I'm really excited to talk with today's guest, Belinda Carroll. She's a queer comedian, activist, and longtime observer of power, culture, and community. And I can't think of a better person to interview for this episode. Hello. Nice to see you.
Good to see you too.
Thanks for being on this podcast.
You're welcome.
I was going to ask you, who are you?
Oh, I thought you were going to see, this is the thing about Michael's booking is that he just picks up people from on the street and then just asks them to. I am Belinda Carroll. I am many things. I am a stand-up comedian, vocalist, writer, actress, and longtime show and festival producer, as well as probably some other stuff. Oh, and gay. I guess that's probably
gay. Important. Yeah. Activist. There's another one.
Oh, yeah. 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 That's something I'm actually, yeah.
You
and also activist.
You give a damn, right? You give a damn.
Well, I mean, I've just done, I was co-organizer for Dyke March Portland for 12 years. And I also have been involved in various and sundry political campaigns. And I've spent the last year being a fundraising director for on behalf of Human Rights Campaign.
Awesome. Do you want to tell them about the story, how I was trying to text you and I was texting Belinda that was actually not Belinda?
Oh, yeah. So, okay, let's go backwards. Okay, so Michael, for those that don't know, Michael and I have known each other for right before the pandemic, and we've known each other for a really long time. And what was I going to say? And then he was my lawyer for a while, and now he's not my lawyer anymore. And so he had my old phone number, but he didn't have my new phone number. Okay, so now that we've got that caught up. So he texts my old phone number, my old Portland, Oregon phone number. And he gets a message back that says, hey, this isn't Belinda. And on top of that, I get calls and texts for Belinda constantly. And so Michael texts me and says, hey, I have two numbers for you. Which is your number? So I was like, all right. And so anyway, and so we start talking to this guy. And I'm Aaron. Like, oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. Well, I said, oh, I'm so sorry. That's my new phone number. Ends up his name's Aaron. He's amazing. He is a graphic designer who's worked with Nike and Michael Jordan and Adidas and like all this stuff. And then Michael was like, oh, no pressure. But what if this is like the time that it's like the guy that texted that woman and then they had Thanksgiving for 15 years together? And so we started talking to Aaron. It ends up that he's a pretty amazing guy.
We were talking to him quite a bit. Like, I went on errands. I was in the grocery store. I was in New Seasons. We were still chatting to this guy who we've never met.
Oh, I know. But now he has tickets to my show next time I'm there.
Wow. So anyways, yeah. How cool
and
is that?
And he does, he does printings for comedians too. And he's done a few like high profile comics. So we were talking about that, and I was like, he told me to hit him up if I wanted graphic design or printing. And I was like, hey, Ryan.
Usually it's the other way. When someone has your phone number or doesn't have your phone number, it's like, who are you? Leave me alone. I don't want to talk to you. Stop contacting me. And he was just so nice. Like,
I know.
Oh.
And then he was like, oh, I'll be your concierge and let everybody know what your new phone number is when they call. I'm like, great.
So, you know, the question that we're asking today is, why do we need comedy when everything's broken? I know that, you know, you've lived an interesting life of all kinds of challenges, but also, hey, guess what? We survived a pandemic and now we're in Trump 2.0. So I just want to ask you, like, point blank, you know, how does comedy help you? How does comedy help other people get through the hard times?
I feel like, so as a broken person, no, I feel like this is the thing. I did grow up, I grew up in a household where no one was like me. Let's put it that way. I grew up in a Southern Missionary Baptist household. And then my brothers are largely conservative. And so, I feel like humor is what got me through all of that. And I feel like the country, and I don't, it's not even, I feel like at this point, but I know that the country right now is being run by people that are the worst example of human beings. And the only way that we get through that is to make fun of them and to laugh and to understand that whatever's driving them is such a mental illness that we, it's a matter of finding the humor and the irony in it, because, you know, it's a reckoning for America for sure. But I really feel like, I was just talking to you, I had a meeting. Do you remember Jeffrey J? Did you ever see Jeffrey J at the festival? Comedian Jeffrey J?
Sounds very familiar.
So comedian Jeffrey J is a trans comedian, and he's coming on board with my agency that we'll be talking about later. And I feel like this is a reckoning for America, but this is really holding up a mirror to regular people that aren't psychopaths. And it's holding up a mirror to what America has become, because essentially what's happening right now is the culmination of this American ethos that has existed since the 80s of me, 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 and Reaganism and supply side economics and trickle down economics. And so you're seeing the culmination of this flawed economic system that Reagan put in place, you know, in the 80s. And then you're seeing the it's like it's on steroids as far as how it's benefiting, you know, billionaires and wealthy folks. And so my thought is, it's if we can get him out before he does too much damage, we can create a new America where we've had this reckoning and we can look at ourselves in the mirror and go, oh yeah, we really do need universal health care. We really do need to have these protections around term limits in Congress. We really do need to get rid of PACs. We really do, you know, and so there's concrete things that we can do in the government to change the government. So the government changing is not my worry. My worry is right now as we speak and people's mental health as we go through it. And because where we end up is where we end up, but your mental health going through the crisis is really what's going to keep you together until we're through it. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the only way I've ever learned how to do that is through laughter and humor and finding that, that thing that makes you giggle, outside of what's happening, because it makes everything else go away, you know?
Yeah. And how far should we go? So, you know, you probably saw the Chrissy Noem South Park episode with her face falling off.
Yes. And South Park was really nailing it. Did you see the Grammys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, they say, like, don't, like, what do they say? Punch up, not down, or, like, don't go too far. I know you don't give a shit, but of course, there's lines drawn. Tell me more about that. Like, I guess maybe it's easier to make fun of people who act like fascist dictators than it is someone who's a group we're trying to protect and care about.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that you shouldn't punch down. That's one of the reasons why, although I have a great respect for Chappelle's career, I no longer listen to Chappelle because Chappelle has horrific opinions on trans people that are based in nothing, right? And so I feel like the government is always punching up. I feel like, making fun of the government is kind of what comedians are, you know? That's why we exist. And that goes back, into the court jester. So it's I think that's kind of our job is to punch up to government and things like that. But I do think there isn't a line as long as it's funny. Do you know what I mean? And so the difference between somebody that is like an open micer doing a, that's right. Hell yeah. All right. I just remembered that there's no language restrictions.
No, okay. This is completely unfiltered. Texted you and I said, bring your dirty mouth.
Yeah. Although my mouth has become not dirty because in LA, they want you to be clean. And I've been working for a cruise ship company for a year. And so I'm completely I had to completely get clean. Like I perform for people that are anywhere from 2 to 97. So it's like, I can't cuss on board anyway. So what I was about to say is, so the difference between an open micer having just like a dick joke you're going to like versus a seasoned comedian having a dick joke that you're going to like is miles apart, right? Because the open micer is going to approach it head on and not have a nuanced opinion about the dick. And somebody that's been doing it for a long time is going to have thought about that subject for a long time. So I think that there's no line if it's done well, but the key in being a seasoned performer is knowing where that line is for you and how much you can get away with. Because the reason I asked you about the Grammys is because Trevor Noah last night did a joke that was so great.
Too busy hoping that he and Bad Bunny were going to make out, but that didn't happen.
Oh, man, that would have been great. They had an exchange too that I'll talk about in a second, but let me talk about this first. So toward the end of the broadcast, they announced very casually that the Grammys is leaving CBS because CBS is all MAGA now. And they'd said we've been with CBS since 1973 and we're leaving CBS and we're going somewhere else. And then later he was like, oh, hey, you guys, I figured out why Trump is so into getting Greenland. It's because now that they've closed down Epstein Island, he needs another island so him and Bill Clinton can hang out.
Yeah.
And it was great. It was a great joke. And so now he's being sued for it because Trump administration is suing.
Oh, really? I didn't read that today, but I'm sure. Oh, yeah. I'm sure because it's all about retribution, revenge, who can I sue?
Well, yeah. Yeah. Oh, so then he looked at the camera and he said, so this is our last year, so what are you going to do about it? the thing is that within that, so that was a really great joke. And so now he's getting sued. And so nothing's going to come out of it, of course. But the thing is that's the method of this administration is like, whatever you don't like, mm-hmm. sue them. And then they'll stop saying it. And so that's what they're planning on. It's just an instill people.
And sometimes they do payouts, like ABC, I believe, did a payout. Like it's sort of Trump knows that sometimes people cave and end up paying him.
Oh, he knows they do all the time. Yeah. I mean, the ABC payout, I think it was like $16 million. And it was just a payout to get him to get off the network, you know? And, but that's the thing is that, and now, CBS is now all whatever. So
I'm going to give you an opportunity if you'll take it, which is to think of the people in the Trump administration, what do you think of Stephen Miller? What do you think of,
I think Stephen Miller is a goblin. The thing is with the administration is that I'm so angry with it. It's really hard to be funny about the administration at this point. Do you know what I mean? Because it's hard. Because it's almost like they're so much of a joke themselves that it's almost difficult to make fun of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and they're doing real things that hurt real people. So
Right.
What do you think about J.D. Vance and his eyeliner?
Oh, you know, the thing is that, like, have you checked out his eyes? I was trying to figure out if it's eyeliner or if his eyes are like that. I think I've decided it's eyeliner. But, like, I just think it's really ironic that anyone that wears that much makeup would then criticize drag queens. Mm-hmm. Like, the only reason that J.D. Vance is criticizing drag queens is because J.D. Vance wants to be a drag queen, like, real bad.
Yeah, there's that photo of him dressing up to be a drag queen. But the other thing is he's changed his name a bunch of times, too. So if...
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, he definitely could have a history of something.
Talk about, like, name changes and dead names and stuff like that. He's basically chosen who he wants to be. And then he says that other people can't be who they are. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing. But you raise a good point about how, like, how do you laugh about things like that?
Well, I think that with all of it, I think that their whole thing is to project whatever's going on onto whoever's, you know, whatever's going on with them onto other people. And so the trans community is the easiest, you know, thing. It's just the same as during Turning Point.
Oh yeah. Let's talk about Erica Kirk.
Yeah. So she's, I think, a legitimate psychopath. The Turning Point, whole funeral thing, mm-hmm. the show or whatever they had, which was insane. It reminded me of, like, if a beauty pageant was planned on just a lot of cocaine. Do you know what I mean? And this is the thing, is that I am, oh, did you hear that Erica Kirk is pregnant?
No, I heard that. Yeah. I heard that Usha was pregnant, J.D. Vance's wife. No. I didn't know Erica Kirk was.
Yes, I just found out like a couple of days ago.
This has been confirmed?
I'm on my phone. Check it. I'm on my phone right now, so I can't check it. But the Turning Point thing. So the Turning Point thing, Grindr went down.
Yeah. Well, that happens at Republican conventions too, right?
Oh yeah, like, but the Turning Point thing, Grindr went down, and they reported on it live, and so but that was the whole thing that it was supposed to be for Charlie Kirk, and then Grindr went down, and I'm just like, they're all like that. They're all experiencing this other life that they don't want anybody to know about, and so they present this Christian front, and then the poor people that are actually trying to be Christian or trying to, you know, have a spiritual life are all lumped in with these folks, you know?
Yeah, the other thing about Erica, I mean, I feel sad for her that she lost her husband. You know, there is that. Uh-huh. But two things can be true, right? You know, she's making money on, like, all kinds of merch and products and things like that. And then there's also that whole, like, tradwife thing. Like, she's telling women, stay in the home, don't work. But then she herself is out, like, grifting people. So I don't like, that's the other thing about some high level Republican women right now. It's like, you're doing work every day and you have some sort of business, but then you're telling women, like, your job is to be a wife and stay in the house and make sandwiches.
Oh no, but that's the thing, is their whole thing is a grift. Their whole thing is to create a ideal life that's over here that people are trying to strive to, and then taking away all their ability to do it. So then you have to depend on them to try to find out how to get the life, and then you never get the life they do, you know?
Yeah.
And so you spend all your money. It's the same exact, and I'm telling you, because I was raised Southern Missionary Baptist, I absolutely know this. My mother was very into evangelical Christians. And so all the church preachers, Jimmy Swaggart, Tammy Faye Baker, like all that. And when that whole situation went down, all of these guys went over to Republicanism. And previously it was evangelicals. And so they would preach and they'd be like, oh, you know, if you're Mrs. Dolores, and you are in Tennessee, and you have $5 to send over to me, Pat Robertson, and I'm gonna save your soul, and you're gonna go to heaven. And like they would tell these people this on TV, and then you know, and then Dolores would send her $5, and then Dolores is eating cat food at the end of the month, and Pat Robertson's in a gold plane, and yeah. So
it was sounds very Joel Osteen, like it's the same thing, gospel, yeah.
And then Swigert was caught with a person. I think it was like Jessica Hahn. No, that was Baker. But anyway, so they're both caught with whatever. And so they all got caught doing their thing. Same thing that's happening right now in the country. Only this is way worse. That was just like a little like one-off thing. And then they got caught doing it, you know?
Well, and they're always talking about like, you know, don't be gay. And this is what masculinity is. And be a man. And men do this. And men sit like that. Like, you know, there's like the Fox News guys, like Jesse Waters is a great example, who seems extremely gay, but he always will talk about like, this is what men do or men don't do. If you're a straight man, do this. So that's the other thing that's interesting about this is like these men not only being hateful against queer folks, but also telling people that if you do that thing, you'll be queer and people won't like you. Or you won't be considered a man, well, like the whole like alpha male.
I was just thinking about this the other day. I was thinking about how, like, the powers that be, the general zeitgeist, sets it up where they position shame, right? So if there's no reason for you to do something, or for you to, you know, like, you need to have, for women, you know, you need to have kids and get a husband and live this exact kind of life, or otherwise you are a lesser woman, right? And so if you buy into that, like, Christian lifestyle, right? And they talk about our lifestyle. they actually do have a lifestyle. But so if you buy into that, and that's where you're, support is, and that's where your family is, and that's where your friends are, right? And you don't live up to that, then there's this sense of shame. And so they control you with that shame. They go, oh, look, you know, you're not doing this and doing that. And that's how they extract money out of you.
Like there's the whole thing J.D. Vance said about like cat ladies and stuff like that. But like, we love cat ladies.
No, and the world needs cat ladies. Like, I'm sorry, but like, you know, we take care of your children that you don't want to take care of. Like, you know, like we're the fun aunts of the group. We're taking your kids on the weekend and not charging you babysitting money. Like, I don't understand why people are against spinster ladies, but, and also I will have you know too, that spinster, I don't know if you know this. Do you know this? The word spinster is derived from women, in the Middle Ages who could support themselves making, fabric. And so they didn't need a man. And so they were called spinsters. And so then that became co-opted and then turned into like a negative, like you can't get a man thing, you know, or, you know. And so anyway, and so, but that's what makes you feel bad about these folks that are in this cult of evangelicalism is that they buy into this and then they, you know, the person that they look up to and they're like trying to be like is doing all the opposite things that they're being told not to do. And so they see this person over here living this fulfilling life where she's like doing speeches and people are telling her that she's great and like whatever. And they're sitting at home, like dealing with three screaming kids and trying to get dinner on the table and they can't live. You know what I mean?
Well, and that's a good point is like a lot of people who are telling other people or other women that like they're financially well off so they can hire like a cook and a nanny and whomever else.
Exactly right. Well, and in a lot of cases, you know, this is the thing about abortion is that, let's just get right into it. this is the thing with it is that, you know, beyond the my body, my choice, you know, I have a right to decide not to grow a human being, my body. But beyond that, the thing is with having a baby is that when you have a baby as a woman, and especially if as a single woman, but most of the time you're married too, you are giving up all autonomy and you're giving up a lot of decisions to be able to make your own decision on like where are you going to work? How much do you want to make? Like what, how much money do you need? You know, that kind of thing. But with women, it narrows us down where now we're only a nurse. And especially if you get, you know, pregnant before you go to college or something, you know, you're a nurse, you're a cook, you're a waitress, you're, you know, but you lose out on a lot of different professional opportunities that you would be able to get if you did not have children. Because like for me, right, like I am, for what I do, a pretty successful person, but I wouldn't have been able to do that if I was trying to manage going to comedy clubs at night and taking care of kids. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but with women, it like really narrows it down. And so that's the thing with abortion being limited is it's a Republican construct to control women so they can stay in these boxes so they can, so they need a man. So they have to be supported by a man. So then they have to support a man.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Well, and the other things to add to that are
and I don't hate men, by the way. Okay. Sorry. No, I know. I don't hate men, but like people hear me talk and they go, oh,
you love men, just not sexually.
No, I just don't want to take care of them. I don't want to be in charge of one. I don't want to like emotionally take care of one. I don't want to get ghosted by one. I don't want, I don't want
to. So the other thing, you brought up abortion. The other things that are interesting are they don't seem to care once the baby is born, like how that baby's doing or how that mother's doing. So like if you're really pro-life, like you would be like, okay, have your baby and then we're going to be here for you with a variety of programs to help you, right? So they don't really do that.
Yeah. Well, no, that's the thing is that there's I mean, they have no social, they don't want any kind of social safety net. And I don't know where that cognitive dissonance comes from.
Yeah,
where
they go, seem very Christian-like.
Babies are great, but we're not going to help you take care of the baby, even though we're forcing you to have the baby, even though you're 16, and you're not going to be, you know, there, and we're not going to give you any maternity leave or any ability to take care of your baby after you have it, but you still have to have the baby.
Well, and the other thing is that a lot of the people who, a lot of people who are pro-life, like a lot of the men who are pro-life in the Republican Party, they encourage their mistress or their daughter or whomever to get an abortion so that people don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole hypocrisy though, is that they want to dictate what people are doing themselves or, you know, and but then in their life, it doesn't matter because it's an exception. We're seeing it all over with Florida. There's a bunch of there's been a bunch of people in Florida that voted for Trump. And now there was a woman that needed a medical exemption and she didn't get the medical exemption. She's like, but I'm going to die. So why, like, you have to give me this medical exemption. And so she had to drive out of state to get that taken care of. And she was like, I always thought that it was a decision people were making and that they were being mean to babies. And now I can see that I needed it for a medical reason. And I wasn't able to get it because of these laws. And so the thing is, when you try to legislate healthcare, you are trying to apply a blanket solution to a very individualized thing. Mm-hmm. And so you see it within everything, you know, but it's the same HRT and trans healthcare. And you'll talk to people that don't understand transness. And then you'll go, okay, well, if you don't understand trans people, do you understand that intersexed people are a thing? Right. And they'll go, oh yeah. Well, yeah. I'm like, okay, well, think of being trans on a spectrum. Some people are very obviously intersexed and some people are very, very not obviously intersexed. And the intersexed only exists inside their body and maybe doesn't show on the outside, but it still exists in the same way that somebody that was born with two types of genitals, and then they choose, you know? So a long time ago, I don't know if you knew about this, a long time ago, back before, you know, transitioning was a thing, and we didn't know the impact of this, people would be born intersex, and then the doctor would just choose whichever was easiest to change into, right? And then the baby would grow up, and then they get hormones. And then, of course, they've just discovered over years that these babies were growing up and then having huge mental crises because they're like, why do I feel like I'm a man, even though I'm presenting as a woman? Like, why? And it was because they were surgically altered without their consent. And so that's been going on forever. And so now with transitioning, it's taking away that hormone replacement therapy from people, but then you're also taking it away from people who have a demonstrated physical medical need, or you know, you know, see what I'm saying? In South Carolina, they completely removed HRT and then found out, wait, women over 45 need HRT, and cis women, you know, we take it, and so. And so they accidentally banned HRT entirely. And then a bunch of menopausal women were like, wait a minute. Do you see what I'm saying?
I mean, you could also say that like breast implants are gender affirming care, and
everything's gender affirming care. Jesus Christ, you know, like my lipstick, you know, like, I mean, you know, is me being gender affirming. I feel I want to feel pretty, you know, it's just like, it's so stupid because you can't take enough away to make people not exist. Yeah. You know, you can't just take things away. And same with abortion. Like, you can't just blanket ban abortion and then expect people to not freak out. I don't know where I'm going. I'm just mad about I'm so mad about so many things now. For years, like, I only had the one thing. I was like, okay, I'm mad about gay rights. And then I was good, you know? And now there's so many things to be mad at. I don't even know what I'm talking about half the time. I'm just like, but yeah, you know, and I don't even feel like I even have like room to talk about abortion, because as a lesbian, I've never faced it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've never even, you know, and so it's like, but yeah, with all of it, it's,
You're alluding to is like, even if you're pro-life, like, why aren't you pro-choice for other people? Like, the idea we're in America, we have a social contract, and it's like, I'm going to let you be you, like, and this could be anybody, right? I'm going to let, you know, Mormon guy have five wives. I'm going to let 80, yeah. I'm going to let 80-year-old go to Las Vegas and marry a stripper. Like, we don't sit here telling people like, hey, you already have four kids. Why are you now going to have eight? I don't, you know, like,
I'm not stopping the orgy at the assisted living facility. And I think that if that's going on, which it is, I watched just 60 minutes about it, then you need to allow me to do my thing. No, but that's the thing, is that it's all hypocrisy, because it's all happening anyway. And that's the same as, you know, back in the 50s, my mom used to talk about, you know, back in the 50s, women would have full on, like, trigger warning for everybody, like raging STIs and not go to the doctor because they didn't want to admit they'd had sex. Like, you know, and so she had a sister that got really ill that way, because she didn't want to go to the doctor because she, you know, and so that's the type of thing they're asking
for things that don't actually mirror what America is, or what America needs, or who.
It's not American, it's human nature. Yeah. Like, it's all of these men that are accused of some of the most heinous crimes that have ever been committed, and they are then applying a unreasonable and outdated morality to the rest of us in order to regain this control of this patriarchal BS, you know, white supremacist lens. And that's the lens they want to live in. So they're, you know, forcing it on us. But the thing is that, and let's bring it back to humor, is that's why comedy is important, is because that's the way that we as little people can talk to them and speak truth to power, and talk to the people that are being misled by this, you know, massively conservative-owned media. And so we can get a different message out there besides what's being asserted.
Who are some of the people who you find the most funniest, or who, either growing up or now, did you go, wow, I love what they're doing, I can't stop laughing? I mean, you seem like someone who would like Joan Rivers. Was that the case or no?
Okay. So I have a complicated relationship in my head with Joan Rivers. I never met her or anything. Yes, I do like this style. I kind of like Joan Rivers' style. I see where you get that, because I've been called body in every newspaper article that's ever existed for me. The thing I didn't like about Joan Rivers is that she was very looksist, and she was acting out her own insecurities. She had a lot of insecurities about her own looks, but she was really body shaming, and I did not enjoy that. I did enjoy, I thought she was really funny. I'm not saying that, but I did think that. Who I really like is Kathy Griffin, and especially right now. Did you know she's Queen of Threads?
I heard about something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So she has been on Threads and posting about the administration, and they tried to cancel her after the head thing.
Yeah.
And so she's been talking about that. I watched her new special. It's insane. It's great. I love it. And she did a really great job. It's like an hour and a half too. It's insane. But anyway, so I feel like she's going into I think she's like almost 70. I think she's going to be she's really going to be hitting it, because she's doing great. So anyway, so I love her. I really liked, I liked Robbie Hoffman's special. Is it called Wake Up? I think it's called Wake Up. If you can look that up, that'd be great. Robbie Hoffman just came out with a special on Netflix. Super funny. They're actually calling her. Did you ever see her at the festival?
Oh, I don't think so. No.
Okay. So Robbie Hoffman.
They're on Hacks now too, right? Or.
They did us. I'll get in that second. So Robbie Hoffman is a Hasidic Jewish lesbian who left Hasidic life to be a lesbian. And so, and I'm paraphrasing. So if Robbie listens to this and I'm getting anything wrong, I don't know, text me. So anyway, so she's been a stand-up forever, and has always been very unique as a stand-up. And then she did a guest spot on Hacks, which Guy Branum is writing on, who also is a festival comic. And so she did Hacks, and as a receptionist for the agency that Jean Smart's character is a part of, that is represented by. And so she played the receptionist, and she was so great that it just exploded her. So now I guess she's talking about, she's doing a show or a sitcom. I don't know about that. But I do know that she just came out with a Netflix special, and it's called Wake Up. And people are heralding her as the new Larry David. John Mulaney was part of the, I think may have executive produced it, but he calls her the new Larry David, like at the beginning of the special. So anyway, it's pretty good. I liked it a lot. And so that's something to check out. And I love Taylor Tomlinson. Do you watch Taylor Tomlinson?
Sometimes, yeah.
I love Taylor Tomlinson.
She's on the late show. Did she take over James Corbin's spot or no?
So, yeah. So, no, not now. So she had two seasons of After Midnight, and it was going wonderfully. And Rachel Scanlon was on there, who's a friend of mine, and Guy and Danielle Perez. And so a bunch of really fantastic, diverse comics. I loved it. And then I don't know what happened, but Colbert got canceled. And then Taylor quit.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that she quit. That's interesting.
Well, no. It's I know why. It's because Paramount is becoming like really owned by Jared Kushner. So the whole thing is the Paramount and CBS are. So they put Barry Weiss in. Do you know about this?
I followed that. A bit. Yeah. Sure. She was responsible for like not airing the detention investigation, and then someone posted it, and then now people have seen more of it than they probably would have. But I think there was she was asking journalists to edit what they found to like appease the Trump administration.
Yeah. And so with her and the rest of Paramount, because, you know, because when Colbert was canceled, his last show is May 23rd. And so when Colbert was canceled, that was a cascade of people leaving Paramount because Colbert was canceled on the understanding that he was losing the network money, mm-hmm. not a chance, losing the network money, even though he was the number one late night talk show in the country. And so they canceled him because he speaks out against the Trump administration. And so that started the cascade. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing, and I don't know about this, Taylor says that she quit, and I don't know Taylor, I'm just mm-hmm. parroting what I've heard. She says that she is a trash panda that just likes to tour with stand-up, which I totally understand because I love live performance too. But I think that Paramount may have approached her and asked her to mm-hmm. do less diversity because a lot of her comics were gay, like a lot, yeah. like a lot were LGBTQ. And I was so happy about it.
Yeah. Well, and there's the, so funny. There was the whole like Jimmy Kimmel, ABC fiasco as well. Oh, so
yeah. I actually did a write-in campaign that went pretty good for that. Because of the canceling, they canceled him like overnight. They just canceled him overnight. And with that, luckily Disney got enough flack and from their shareholders, which you're a lawyer. Maybe you have people that are shareholders watching this. You're on 700 boards.
did you just snort? That was amazing.
If you are a shareholder, you should know that you have the power to change all this shit by objecting to it. When your stupid corporation comes to you and says, we want to end DEI, be like, no. Have you seen Target? Have you seen Harley Davidson? Have you seen these people? Because they're losing money because of these stupid policies. And I do not understand like what the deal is, but I do, are like why are they are going along with it? I have a suspicion that every single one of them is in the Epstein file.
The executives of like Target and stuff like that. Is that what you mean?
Everybody just like, you know what I mean? Because like just everybody that's gone, like Zuckerberg, he overnight from being like Mr. Harvard liberal yeah. guy with an Asian wife was all of a sudden like, oh yeah, no, I totally agree. And I'm going to,
is most of these high powered executives or politicians, they have wives who are either immigrants or children of immigrants.
That's what I'm talking about. Every single bit of their shit is hypocrisy.
Yeah.
They just live just mired in hypocrisy. Like, you know, I don't understand. See, and for me, and this may be because of my mouth. So, you know, like I was talking to, I was having drinks with a friend, you know, Red Bull. But I was having drinks with a friend the other night and we were talking about this and we were talking about how I don't understand how you wake up every day with a husband that's actively
Usha or Asha? You're talking about J.D. Vance's wife?
J.D. Vance's wife, yeah. It's Asha, right?
I think it's Usha, but I don't know.
Oh, it's Usha. Sorry. Sorry, Usha. No, I don't know how you wake up every day and you have a husband that's like actively attacking your people and deporting your people and look your children in the face.
Yeah, his, do you know what I mean? His kids are multiracial, but also his in-laws are Indian immigrants.
Right. I mean, but everybody, so essentially, everybody in J.D. Vance's direct life is of Indian descent. And so, like, that would be like if I married a Black person and my parents are both dead now. And so I married a Black person, their parents still alive, and then I became family with all of them. And then I did, and then I ran for government for some reason, and then I enacted laws to oppress them and then started deporting them out of the country.
Yeah. So you know, I want to know.
It's the same kind of thing. It's like, what is the deal with But I don't understand how the wives are dealing with it. Like, I don't understand how, you know, and I feel bad for them. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I have empathy because you didn't marry that person. You married a guy that dressed in drag once and took soup.
Well,
to
that's the thing with J.D. Vance. I mean, he became what Peter Thiel, very conservative gay Republican. Similarly, Tim Cook, gay and bowing down to Donald Trump. So J.D. Vance, just like he's doing for Trump, you know, kind of kissing the ring, he did that for Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel was like, I'm going to introduce you to people who have investment money or can pay your way to anything you want. So I want to ask you, I wanted to talk to you about, is it called Gabers or Gaberhood? What's it called?
It's called the Gabers Agency.
Yeah. So tell us all about that.
And so, essentially, the Gabers Agency is Todd Murray, who had the biggest LGBTQ booking agency in the country pre-pandemic, and Logan Lynn, who is a musician who has like 20 albums, and he's on Kill Rock Stars, and he works with Portugal the Man. He's on the management team for them. And so I'm coming on board. They're starting a comedy department, essentially. And so I'm coming on board as the national director for Comedians in Demand. And so I'll be booking colleges and corporates and brand deals and stuff like that for an LGBTQ roster, essentially.
Cool. That sounds really cool.
And then also touring myself and doing stuff like that.
That sounds great. So are you ready for the final segment?
Sure.
Okay, so this is actually new, but if it works out well, we'll continue it. So the final segment, it's called Why Is It Like This? So basically, it's a fun one where you and I will both name a person, a place, or a thing that could be or should be better. So you can go off on a system, a product, a norm, a situation. So mine is kind of silly today. I'll go first and then you can go. Mine today is brown paper bags. I don't understand why brown paper bags have handles that immediately fall off and none of them seem to work. And you can't hold the handles and walk to your car because all your groceries are going to fall on the floor. And they're just, are they just supposed to be decorative? Are we supposed to hold all bags like this and not have a handle? So I don't understand, like, why can't they just make handles that work on bags? Like, why is that such a difficult thing?
I don't know, but it makes me think that you go to better grocery stores than I do because my brown paper bags don't even have handles.
Okay, so now it's your turn. What's something that you think should be better right now, or that you feel like, you know, why is it like this?
Everything right now. Everything. It's insane. It's insane. Like, okay, this is the thing, is that it feels like everything is a scam. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's been so. What I am asking is, why is it like this? Is why is it that you can only shop online now, and the easiest thing is to shop online. But then when you buy something and it comes to you, it is bullshit. It's absolute bullshit. It doesn't work. You're like, oh, I'm buying this thing. It's going to be $17. Oh, that's a pretty good price for that $17. And then it comes to you, and then it does not work the way it's not even the thing.
Are you buying things on Wish or Temu, or what are you
doing? No, I have bought Temu before, I'll be honest with you. And then I did not do, because that's even worse. I have a skirt actually from Temu. We'll talk about why I like this. I have a skirt from Temu that was like a black pencil skirt. And I was like, oh, perfect. Right. And it came, and it is a off black kind of pencil-y skirt. And then it has a pocket square, but right in the, on my belly for no reason. And it's not a pocket. It's just a pocket square. It's a fake pocket. But when you put the skirt on, it's right on your belly button. Why is that like that? Why is everything soft now? Do you remember when you used to get like a shirt or pair of pants or something, and then it would last you for approximately 27 years. Do you know what I mean? Like, it would go through everything. You'd be like, oh, I've had this since high school, you know?
Yeah.
And now it lasts like 2 seconds. I think maybe my why is it like this? It's fast fashion.
Yeah, yeah. Also, they just make things cheaper so that you buy another one quicker.
Yeah, but I also think that it's also because of it's basically that. It's like planned obsolescence, but the planned obsolescence is like you wear it three times and it breaks, you know, or you use it three times and it breaks. And so you just end up with like a bunch of crap around you.
So your why is it like this is why do we buy online stuff that ends up all being shit?
Yes. And the reason I bring it up is because I have been doing TikTok shop. And so I went into TikTok shop being very excited about it and being like, okay, like I need stuff. I'll buy stuff through TikTok shop and then I'll do a little review and then maybe I'll earn the money back that I bought it with, you know, I'm not, you know, and I didn't buy the whole like, oh, $10,000 a week or whatever, you know, people are always on TikTok talking about that. But, and I started to do it and then like literally everything, and I'm only talking about this because I'm pretty sure I'm going to get off TikTok because of the whole ownership thing, but everything I bought off there, except for like two or three things, complete garbage. Like, I mean, just total garbage. And I'm just like, how are you surviving as a business if everything that you are giving to people is breaking or doesn't work in the first place? Like, I got this like jelly. This is the most girly thing on the planet. But so if you are a Gen X woman and you were 12 around, let's say 1992, then we were obsessed with like glowy glitter, unicorny things, the My Little Ponies and such. And they had like a jellyfish lamp, and it was supposed to be like a projection jellyfish lamp, barely even glows. There's no projection. There's no projection at all. And so what am I going to do? You know, anyway,
what'd you do with it? Throw it away?
No, I just look at it and then I'm mad. That's it. And this is the thing too. Oh, and this is the other thing too, is that I have ADD, which is a lot of the country. Do you have ADD?
I believe so. I mean, if you look at my life, and my therapist is like, I can diagnose you if I want. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, if you want to, sure. But yeah, I clearly do. I mean, when I drink coffee, I become focused and calm and, you know, I'm in like 25 directions at once. So yeah, I do. I've just figured out over the years how to systematize it or deal with it. Yeah.
So me too. And I now have the pieces in place for all of it. But returns, when you have ADHD, this is the thing, is that returns specifically target people with ADHD because it is very difficult to get a thing, not like the thing, get mad enough at the thing to return it and then remember to return it. Like that last.
Yeah, that makes sense. So the likelihood that you're going to figure out how to like ship it back or put in a complaint, I mean, or whatever is very low.
Just the thought of it is exhausting. And so my roommate, though, my housemate is organized, which is weird. And she goes and she orders something and then she just returns it. And I'm like, how do you even do it? Like, because I have to remember how to do it. And I'm not remember how, just remember to do it. And then I'll like go to return it. And then it's like 33 days later. And so they don't take it back after 33 days. And so anyway, so that's why, that's what I wonder why it's like that.
That's great. I have really enjoyed talking with you and seeing you.
Yay.
Continue what you're doing. It's great. I love that you're doing comedy, but also you have activism through your comedy, which is excellent.
Especially right now. You know, that's the thing is that when I went into comedy, and I know you know this, but when I went into comedy, you know, I went into it with the idea that it was an activist act, because when I first started comedy, I was in a band, and my band was like a jazz trio, and there was like a little like keyboard guy and drum guy, and it was called BD Express. And so when I was doing that, they liked me until they realized I was gay, and they, you know, and he was like, oh, your voice, and you're this and you're that. And then they found I was gay, and then they didn't like my audience. And so that's when I started comedy, and because Holly Lorca and Allie Rollison, who are still friends of mine, who are no longer comics, which is really funny. They were doing comedy, and so that's why I started comedy. And so I started as an activist act. And so when I started doing activism in Portland and really getting further into like Northwest Pride and the Dyke March and everything, Northwest History Tours and, you know, whatever, it was all an extension out of that. You know, I feel like stand up is the core, and then, you know, everything kind of branches out from that, you know, but stand up is like, you know, the core. But I will say, if you are listening to this and you are a artist, and especially comedy and music, right now is the most important time for you to exist, because no matter what happens in this, whatever happens, we will absolutely need to have some relief from it. And the healthiest way for you to do that is expression of your feelings through music and through comedy and through art or poetry or, you know, whatever you want to do, you know, because that's the way that we both live through this, but it's also how we document it and how we teach other people, because when this is over, we're going to want other people to remember that it happened so it doesn't happen again. So, you know what I mean? So like the onus of the artist right now is not only to emotionally uplift people, but also to be an activist through your art and document all this.
Well, we've reached the end of this episode of All American Why. If you made it this far, congratulations. You're officially an excessive thinker too. If something today made you laugh, cringe, or reconsider everything you thought you understood about this country, good. That's the point. Subscribe, rate, review, and share All American Why wherever you get your podcasts, including on YouTube. Or don't. It's still a free country for now. You can find me, Michael Jonas, on social media or at allamericanwhy.com. where we're building community for people who still give a damn. All American Why is filmed and recorded at X-Ray FM Studios in North Portland, Oregon. Original music by Renezra and Views. Audio editing by Kyle Gilmore of Residual Audio. Until next time, keep your curiosity loud, your optimism spiteful, and your democracy under constant surveillance. This is All American Why. Thank you for listening. All American why? All American why? All American why? Ask yourself the American why?